Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Protest, pandemic, recession, we've had a lot on our minds lately, as well we should. But this week, some topics that have been overshadowed by current events, but are, we believe, still very important. Things like what it's going to take for Kentuckians to really improve their chances of creating or landing jobs that are interesting, that pay well enough to enjoy life, and are satisfying. Well, that takes us to the intersection of education, entrepreneurship, and economic development. And Dr. Lee Todd, former president of the University of Kentucky and host interviewer of a new series here on Eastern Standard.
I'm talking to Chris Kimmel, the co-founder of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation and also the co-founder and chairman of a new exciting company here in Kentucky called Space Tango. Chris, give us a little idea about where you're from and how did you get into this whole science, technology, engineering, and math area?
Well, interestingly enough, in a very circuitous way, my undergraduate and graduate degrees are actually in social work. I actually never did that per se, but that's where, you know, I got a pretty good diverse education in that. And then once I got out of school, I had the opportunity to start. I worked for Steve Beshear when he was Attorney General and Lieutenant Governor. And during that time, got involved in really an interest in a project called Kentucky Tomorrow, which Lee Todd was also a major player. And that really got me into getting kind of immersed in the whole science technology arena.
Yeah, I've always found it interesting about your College of Social Work, because so many people are saying today that in order to get a really good job, you got to go into science or technology, engineering, math, biology, physics, chemistry, something like that. But yet you've been able to make a career, an outstanding career, coming out of a college that people would not have expected. What do you think about that whole argument?
There's no such thing as useless knowledge. And I think it's just a question of how you apply it. And I've always been a firm believer in really true creativity and innovation emerges at the intersection of different kinds of disciplines, including science and technology, the humanities, arts, philosophy, et cetera. And when you mash, you know, kind of mash those things together and integrate them, that's where a lot of the really creativity, emerges. And so I think, you know, you can take your education. Now, obviously, if you're going to be a brain surgeon, you got to have a medical degree. But there's increasingly now jobs and opportunities in the world today that just require smart, creative people.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you started with that Kentucky Tomorrow project and also co-founded KSTC, the Science Corporation, what was your concept behind why they were needed here in Kentucky?
These were back in the mid and late 80s. I think Kentucky is known for a lot of things, and a lot of progressive things have happened. Unfortunately, science, technology, and innovation hasn't historically been one of them, at least recent history. And I think it was just a recognition that we need some independent voices and independent strategies looking at some of these late 20th century, 21st century opportunities. And, of course, science, technology, and innovation are right at the center of that.
You recognized long ago that education and engineering tied very tightly to the future economy, and I think you've made an impact. The initial focus for the Science Corporation was P-12 education. And why did you choose and what were you trying to accomplish in starting there?
You know, again, it was a brand new company and a brand new opportunity. And you know, I think you start at the beginning, right? I think the beginning of innovation is education. And so I think we had a recognition that a good place to kind of dig our heels in and really begin to focus on this was in education. And actually, interestingly enough, was really an elementary education. We were very fortunate and we were able to put together a pretty interesting strategy that was funded by the James Graham Brown Foundation that called ACES, Activity Centered Elementary Science, that really got into the nooks and crannies of teachers' classrooms all over the state and elementary school with very activity-centered science and kind of a new way of teaching science. You know, we started where we thought we needed to and then evolved from there.
And one follow-on to that was Advanced Kentucky and the Science Council, a science corporation, along with a few other universities in Kentucky, applied for some ExxonMobil money to do something in this area. Some people may remember when Phil Mickelson was on TV advertising the math and science area. What was Advanced Kentucky, and where does it stand today?
Advanced Kentucky was an effort that was led by Kentucky Science Technology Corporation a number of years ago. It involved a coalition of lots of different people in Kentucky, the Kentucky Department of Education, universities, schools, et cetera, et cetera. And it was at that time a very competitive, I think it was close to $14 million award, and ExxonMobil was giving out just a handful of those nationally to really reform science and math education, particularly in the area of advanced placement was one of them, and some of the other things that were focusing on those kinds of courses. And Kentucky was successful. Joanne Lang at that time headed it up, and it's now headed up by a gentleman named Anthony Myers, who's a former classroom teacher. And it, originally we got that $14 million came into the state. That was supplemented by millions of dollars in additional funding and grants and other kinds of things. And it really has had a tremendous impact when you look at the hard data and the numbers on turning around STEM education in Kentucky, particularly among underrepresented groups, has had really quite an impact.
And one of the things I think that was unique is that there were no hurdles that students had to go over in order to take those AP classes. And for our audience, the AP classes, if you pass those in high school, then they can give you college credit. So it's a good way to get a jump start. What were some of the other features of Advanced Kentucky that you think made it so successful?
Well, I think what you just hit on, Lee, is really one of them, the idea that it was open access. You know, we so much in our society at all levels, we put up barriers to people and say, okay, well, you have to go over these hurdles before we're even going to give you an opportunity to do something. And, you know, we all have different talents. Some people do well on those kinds of hurdles. Some people do well testing on that kind of thing. But I think one of the things that the philosophy of advanced placement, which was so important, and I think you hit on it, was the fact that it was open to everybody. You had a shot. If you wanted to try it, you had an opportunity to try it. And we didn't filter people out before it started. It's also very hands-on, a lot of hands-on training with students and teachers. And I think that philosophical change, it was really a big difference.
The students, I think, got some remuneration if they passed their AP exams, and the teachers got paid extra in order to take the training and to start offering these courses. And many of these AP courses were in schools that had never had those before. Is that true?
Yep, that's correct. And that's one of the other novel things. There was actually financial incentives, both for students and for teachers, to participate and be successful in the program, which was really quite unprecedented in many respects. And that was another interesting feature. So when the students, not only did they get the reward of being successful and passing and et cetera, they also got a financial reward. I think it was in the neighborhood of $100. And teachers also had rewards that they were given for their participation.
Yeah, I met a young lady recently who went to a school that didn't have AP classes until Advanced Kentucky came in. She took some classes, and when she got her grades back, she made a 5. And for our audience, a 5 is the top thing you can get, and that there aren't that many 5s even now in many states. She told her mother that there's an error here. I can't do this well. This isn't possible. Now that young lady is a senior at UK at engineering, and said she would never have done it had she not been able to believe in herself at that point in time. So,
yep, I think that's a great. I mean, I think we're all. You know, we do that too much to people, both young and old, you know, say, oh, this is going to be too hard for you. You can't reach this high, et cetera. And I think when you at least give people an opportunity, they achieve things that perhaps they didn't believe they could do.
Well, you know, one of the tasks that we talked about years ago when KST got started was Kentucky's economic development approach was to recruit companies to come here and build factories. We'd draw them here because of our cheap land, our cheap labor, and give them tax incentives. Well, those jobs mainly now are in other countries, Mexico, Taiwan, China. They're not here anymore. And what people demand is to have a supply of talent that can be competitive worldwide. And so you're doing things now to try to get students to look into these areas in order to be competitive and offer us a workforce that will be able to attract other companies here and, as well, as we'll talk about in a moment, start their own companies.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Family budgets are really tight right now, and they're having to make a lot of decisions about, you know, how to spend their money. What is in it for a young person to pursue a STEM education? once they finish high school?
Well, I think, you know, so much of the 21st century is being shaped and driven by science and technology and engineering and the technical fields. And again, I think also coupled with, people call them soft skills. I don't think there are soft skills. You know, the ability to relate to people, the ability to write, to be creative, to create narratives, and things like that are also incredibly important. And so I think that, you know, given where we're headed, a STEM education is one of the really good preparations in perhaps finding a job or, you know, creating your own job, whether it be a startup company with other employees or a small business or something like that. Those skills, those math, technology, science, critical thinking skills have turned out to be basically irreplaceable in today's world.
I was in a meeting once with the vice president of human resources who did the hiring for Boeing, and he made a comment to our group. He said, I don't think I've ever fired an engineer because they couldn't do engineering, but I fired quite a few engineers who couldn't work with other people, who couldn't write, who couldn't keep a schedule, who weren't tolerant of other, you know, foreign people they had to work with. And then he looked at the ceiling and he kind of said to himself, you know, I think this thing we used to call soft skills are really the harder skills.
Yep, exactly. And I agree. I remember one time when I was out in Silicon Valley and I was having a breakfast with a young woman who actually was a UK grad. She'd graduated with a degree in one of the sciences. And I think it was psychology, actually. And she was working for, I believe it was Google or, you know, one of those companies. And I asked her, I said, well, that's kind of interesting. You know, you're working with it, you know, a psychology degree. I would think, you know, they would have something engineering or computer science. She said one of the interesting things out here in the West Coast is that they're just interested in smart people. Mm. They don't care what your degree's in. They'll figure it out.
Well, the other area that you focused in was in increasing university research. Can you say a few words about what that's doing nowadays?
Well, our university and private research development has long been the fuel of new breakthroughs and new kinds of companies. And there was an effort, there's always been efforts in Kentucky, and the Kentucky Science Technology Corporation, in collaboration with a group called Kentucky F-Score, helped form a coalition, a partnership, to help dramatically increase federal funding for competitive research into research and development. And I don't have the numbers handy, but I know the research numbers have increased measurably across the state and all the universities, and particularly UK and U of L. And I think that was partly, not all of it, but partly a result of that.
You know, that's where ideas come from to start businesses. I did get some numbers on that. In 1998, when Governor Patton charged UK and U of L to become research universities, major ones, the total research funding for Kentucky was $150 million. Today, it's $600 million. So a fourfold increase in that. It's going to give us a many-fold increase
Absolutely.
In ideas.
Those are significant numbers. And those numbers, that knowledge translates into new inventions, new developments, new companies, new jobs.
Well, your third focus was looking at how to change the economy in Kentucky. And so what was the philosophy there?
Well, I think it was just what we said. It was really a refocus, not exclusively. I mean, you know, you still want to recruit good companies, but a refocus away from the majority of focusing on recruitment and retention and really focusing on the creation of new kinds of jobs and entrepreneurship and tapping the kind of inherent creativity of our people into creating new jobs. I mean, obviously yourself, Lee Todd, when you founded DataBeam, one of the very, very early examples of a successful technology startup in Kentucky, and that ended up, you know, being successfully sold. Those were the things that we were really focusing on, was trying to get building on the knowledge coming out of research and building on that kind of knowledge and getting people to understand you can create your own job. You don't necessarily, being employed is not necessarily working for someone else. A lot of the jobs, in some cases, a lot of data suggests most of the new jobs over the past 10, 15, 20 years in this country have been, in fact, created by new startup companies that evolved. So that was a major focus as well.
Well, I mentioned that you're a chairman of Space Tango, which is one of the startup companies that spun out of UK. Just tell us a second about Space Tango, and did they have anything on that mission that SpaceX just put into orbit the other day?
We did not. Space Tango, yes, I was a co-founder of Space Tango that spun out with Kentucky Science Technology Corporation with collaboration from UK and U of L and other universities. So we started out as a nonprofit company called Kentucky Space, and once we got some real traction, it evolved into a for-profit company which spun out of Kentucky Space, which is now called Space Tango. There's really now up to about 16 or 17 employees, and we're literally a research, development, and manufacturing company. We just don't do our work on the planet Earth. We have two labs permanently installed on the International Space Station. While we did not have anything on this recent launch, we actually, through a SpaceX agreement with NASA, our major partner, we do launch primarily on SpaceX. Fundamentally, we launch experiments of a variety of nature, materials, mostly in the biotech, biomedical area, to the International Space Station, and those experiments are conducted in our laboratories, fully automated, to further really help us understand how different systems, cells, molecules, genetics, all these kinds of things, drugs, operate outside of gravity in a zero-G environment, with the idea that those kinds of insights will give us new insights into the function of these systems and ways to improve them, and also ultimately that we absolutely believe that we will be manufacturing, in fact, we're already started to do some preliminary manufacturing, actually manufacturing new kinds of material and biotechnology products in zero-G for application and use on Earth.
Well, I know that, in fact, in my experience, Kentuckians can compete in this so-called new economy if they can be competitively educated and they can begin to believe that they can compete. And so students who take those STEM classes and those AP classes that you've mentioned can help us develop a more competitive economy and create better jobs in the state of Kentucky.
Absolutely.
I've been talking with Chris Kimmel of the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation of Space Tango here in Lexington. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you, Lee.
I'm a space cowboy, bet you weren't ready for that. I'm a space cowboy, I'm sure you know where it's at, yeah, 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 yeah.
UK has an Office of Technology Commercialization that helps faculty, staff, and students navigate their way from bench to business. And here's one example. One spinoff from the University of Kentucky began as a company called Global Ag Risk, created to offer financial disaster risk management solutions with the aim of helping at-risk populations prepare for and survive catastrophic events, things like drought, floods, and earthquakes. It was founded by our guest, Dr. Jerry Skies, Professor Emeritus in Agricultural Economics at the University of Kentucky, who has over 30 years of experience in developing financial disaster risk management solutions. And he joins us to talk about an outgrowth of Global Ag Risk, a company called Global Parametrics. Greetings, Dr. Skies.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
And if you would set the stage for us first by providing a little bit of background, what has been your aim and focus in creating first Global Ag Risk and then Global Parametrics?
Well, I guess it starts from my farm background. I grew up on a farm in Hardin County, and, you know, weather risk was always in our metrics of thinking about how you manage a farm. And I went into Michigan State to do a PhD in agricultural economics. I was focused on public policy right out of the program. When I came to the University of Kentucky, I started working on the federal crop insurance program. We built something special there, and then the world kind of noticed it. We built it out of the University of Kentucky for the federal crop insurance program, and that was in 1990. And the World Bank invited me to do some similar work in developing countries, and I went off to Nicaragua in 1995 and really got drawn into the international work. So that's the way this thing has progressed in my life. It was great along the journey because with the World Bank, it started bringing the link between development, poverty, natural disasters into a much larger story for me to understand the economics of what happens when there is a disaster and how it impacts the poor the most. That happens in this country as well as developing countries, but this country, at least we've got resources that we can help when a natural disaster happens. But in a lot of the countries that we work in, we don't have those resources. So I got more and more interested, more and more drawn into the international work with natural disasters.
Well, the attention that you received, the global attention, must have been exciting for the University of Kentucky. What did UK do to help you get your company up and running?
The university was completely supportive. And as things progressed, I started teaching the development economics course because of this international experience. started giving PhD students more access to these kind of data and academic puzzles to work on. So it was really a win-win, I think, for everyone.
Many say it's pretty tough to start a company in Kentucky because of a lack of investment capital. And I'm wondering, given that, how have you financed your company and what are your thoughts regarding future growth?
Global Ag Risk was self-financed. Of course, it was projects that really brought in the revenue. We had projects in Peru and Mongolia, Vietnam. We ultimately started working even in Indonesia on earthquakes. So we were doing that good work, and we had support from Gates Foundation, Ford Foundation. But when it came time to make the next step, the Germans looked at what we were doing, and they came to me one day and said, we'd like you to write a business case to scale this work up. That was in 2010. Now, that was a completely different proposition because that was going to be a company that really had to have capital. And it was clear that both the German government and the British government were interested in the work that we'd been doing, and they were willing to take the journey with us. Now, it took 6 years to get the capital, but we got the first equity capital for Global Parametrics from the British government through their Department for International Development. And from the German government through a fund that's managed, it's called the Insure Resilience Investment Fund. And, of course, this was really good because the way we built the business case for this type of activity to bring capital markets into developing countries, we had to make the case of why they weren't there in the first place, and it would require patient capital in order to do that. So the public investment was quite good. The whole plan was to bring the public investor, then impact investors. Those impacted investors could be in this community, by the way. And we now actually have third-party advisors working with us to build the capital raising campaign, which could include capital markets, and we intend for it too. And we're going to start that campaign in earnest.
And how many people do you employ? Where are they?
The home office is actually in London, England. Because the British were the investor. There's a subsidiary company that's Global Parametrics R&D that's here in Kentucky, and that's where I am. We have about 20 people all over the world. Half a dozen of those are in the home office in London. We have about 4 in Lexington with some interns and consultants on top of that. We have professionals in Barcelona and Zurich, Seattle, Washington, D.C., where another colleague is working with the World Bank and American Development Bank and some of those agencies out of Washington. So we're quite a global company. And, you know, it's been to our advantage that we were actually working remotely, especially in light of current conditions, because we haven't missed a beat. We're all in different offices. We're in different space. But we are working as hard as we can right now because we know our solutions are needed even more with a fragile world that's going to be created by the current pandemic.
Let me see if I understand what you do. So as I understand it, you're using the data that you gather, and with that, you're able to foresee these natural disasters and help prepare people who are in harm's way, perhaps a tropical cyclone on the way, a hurricane, earthquake, maybe an extreme temperature or rain event. Is that what you do? And can you give us an example?
So to be really clear about the company, we are a commercial company with a social mission, and we do a number of things. As a company that's focused on natural disasters, we've built a massive amount of data in order to actually understand the risk and to structure contracts, and we actually provide monitoring and forecasting services for extreme events. And then we have a fund where the clients can actually take a position of risk transfer and transfer those risks out of those countries into our natural disaster fund and basically manage the risk in that fashion. When you use the word foresee, it's an interesting word to think about. Let's break it down. The first thing is because of the data that we have a profile of the history. And we could actually give a client knowledge about how frequent an extreme event will occur, what we call a return period. that's very valuable information, because if the event's going to happen, you know, 5 years, that's one thing. But if it's going to happen every 50 years, how you organize the financing before the event is very different when you think about the data analytics that we provide. And that's so important, because in order to manage risk, people need to understand the risk. So that's a big part. The second thing about 4C that we do is we actually have forecast-based financing products, which have become very popular in the humanitarian community. And some of the early work of Global Ag Risk, we laid a foundation for a lot of this, because we built the first forecast insurance product in the world on El Nino that would pay before the catastrophic flooding started in the northern part of Peru, on the basis of all the business interruption that was taking place for people to get prepared. And maybe the listener knows that El Nino is a very, very strong signal and gives a lot of warning about bad conditions to come in different parts of the world. So it's a very good signal to use for forecast-based financing.
What is the present capacity of the fund that you draw from when you're going to support a project in some part of the world that is about to encounter some sort of natural disaster?
So we've been blessed. The British government gave us an equivalent of about $30 million in this natural disaster fund. The Germans have recently placed $25 million equivalent U.S. dollars. And we have a reinsurer that's very strong called Hanover Re that will match that funding. So all in all, we have access to about $110 million of capital in order to write these contracts and provide this funding.
I wonder where our listeners could go if they're really interested to learn more about what you do.
Yeah, certainly. Our website is globalparametrics.com, and there's a bit of information there. If they want to know deeper some of the academic thinking that goes behind it, the globalagrisk.com website is still open, and it has a number of papers. Readers could read a lot. But I'm happy to answer questions as well if anyone wants to email me directly. It's jskees@globalparametrics.com.
Jerry Skees, Professor Emeritus in Agricultural Economics at the University of Kentucky and founder of Global Ag Risk and Global Parametrics. Thanks so much, Dr. Skees.
Thank you, Tom.
Program note, I mentioned last week that we would be featuring during this edition a conversation with Catherine Engel of the UK Appalachian Center about the Stinking Creek area of Knox County. Well, due to the swirl of recent events, we've become a bit backlogged. That interview will be featured at a later date, but soon. Coming up after the break...
You know, the forecaster saying, hey, there could be thunderstorms. Nobody predicted the kind of windstorm that blew up.
That was over Easter weekend. The storm damage in several eastern Kentucky communities was extensive. It still is. And taking the treatment of mental health online.
The pandemic has really forced the issue.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at WEKU.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
It may not qualify as the kind of natural catastrophe capturing the attention of our previous guest, Dr. Skees, but
What happened in parts of eastern Kentucky over the recent Easter holiday left impact and lingering aftermath in its path. Several communities were unexpectedly hit by a powerful storm that brought with it severely damaging winds. Thousands of people lost power for several days, all while Kentuckians across the Commonwealth were asked to shelter in their homes during the coronavirus pandemic. Samantha Morrill talked to Scott McReynolds, Executive Director of the Housing Development Alliance in Perry County, who tells us that some people have still been unable to repair the damage brought on by the storm.
Scott, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's great to be here.
Can you tell us about the Easter storms and what was leading up to it? As I understand, a lot of people had stocked their homes with food in preparation to shelter at home, and then these storms came through.
Yeah, we had these tremendous storms and took out a lot of trees and knocked down a lot of power lines. And, you know, some of the pictures were really shocking. And you have these huge trees wrapped up in the power lines, and that just meant it took a long time to restore power. And so, you know, one of the big impacts we had were folks who had stocked up for food, filled up the freezer, and suddenly there's no power for several days. And so I think a lot of people lost some of their stockpiles or had to scramble to make other arrangements to save them. I know we were buying ice and keeping everything we had, in coolers trying to save it.
You say people were scrambling. How much advanced warning did they have that these storms were coming through? Did people have time to secure generators and buy ice ahead of time? Or was there a mad rush to get these items?
Yeah, no, there really wasn't the typical thing, the forecaster saying, hey, there could be thunderstorms. Nobody predicted the kind of windstorm that blew up. And I know I was at Lowe's a couple of days after the storm and overheard the sales manager explaining to the store, to a customer that they had, they were taking names at 6 o'clock in the morning and they had a list already, that was several pages long of people looking for generators and just, it was really unusual too. Normally it's the outlying areas of the county that go without power. So those of us who live a little farther out of town are maybe a little better prepared, but this was, some of the last places to get back power were actually right in the town because of, the bigger and the older trees that fell. And, so I think some of the folks who did get hit, were not as prepared, because they typically don't go without power.
How widespread was the damage? We know that wind knocked down trees and limbs, sometimes large trees. Were homes and businesses damaged in these storms as well as the power?
Yeah, there were quite a few businesses damaged. Our particular organization, we were fortunate enough to have a funder provide us some flexibility to provide some emergency repairs. And we had, I think, landed up with close to 50 requests for emergency repairs from storm damage.
What kind of damage was that? Was it windows being knocked out or real, like, heavy-duty structural damage?
Well, the most common was probably shingles getting blown or tin getting blown off of a roof. We did have a couple of houses that had trees, either the entire tree or a big branch hit and caused some structural damage and some siding blow off, that sort of thing.
If you're just tuning in, I'm joined by phone with Scott McReynolds, Executive Director of the Housing Development Alliance. So we were in a shutdown when these storms hit. How did the coronavirus pandemic and businesses being shut down, social isolation, affect the recovery effort?
Well, for us, we had actually suspended our home repair program in terms of going in and doing any kind of new home visits that we couldn't because of the lack of social distance. And so we had to scramble around and figure out how we could safely go out and do home visits and interact with customers in order to maintain the social distance while still meeting their needs. And storm damage is typically on the exterior house, so that made the repairs a little bit easier, although some homes did have water damage. And so that was, again, it forced us to get back into home repair quicker than we had anticipated.
The coronavirus pandemic and all of the shutdowns were very difficult for a lot of people. But when you add on to that, being without power for days up to a week or more, and then also having damage to your home, which is supposed to be your shelter, your safe place to be during a pandemic, how did this affect people who were going through it?
You know, for me, I think the first reality check was when I heard a meteorologist basically telling people that you know, being safe from the actual storm is, you know, Trump social distancing. So if you needed to crowd into a basement, you should do that. So it, you know, it definitely changed a lot of things, and the pandemic made it harder. And I think you're exactly right. You know, without power suddenly, I mean, I know both school systems just basically announced and said, even though we're on this non-traditional instruction days, don't even worry about homework this week because so many people didn't have power or electricity, you know, and so in this day, you know, it's the internet and the entertainment that requires electricity, I think, is what keeps people sane at home. And suddenly they were without that. And then the challenges of food. I know the next day after the storms, the fast food restaurants had huge lines in their drive-throughs because people couldn't prepare food at home. And so, yeah, it really upended everything.
What does the recovery look like now? Everybody has power, hopefully, 2 months out from these storms. But what about all the damage that was done? Is it repaired now?
So, yeah, I believe everybody has power. And we still have we were able to, I think, get somewhere between 30 and 40 houses approved for emergency repairs, and we're still working through that list. We've tried to tarp everybody's house, you know, that was actively leaking. But it takes a while to recover, and, you know, a pandemic certainly doesn't make that any quicker.
So there are people right now, there are tarps on their homes protecting them from the elements. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, if you've lost a roof and it's leaking and it's going to take a few weeks, you know, because with 30 to 40 homes to repair, you know, we can only do so many at a time. But we, you know, those that were had serious leaks, we tried to patch enough to keep them from leaking so that we could, they didn't experience any more damage while they were waiting to get the permanent repair.
With a storm of this magnitude and 40 to 50 people needing repairs and assistance, how is your organization now prepared for the next storm that may come through?
I think for us, we don't typically deal with emergencies like this, and so we had to change some systems and just some expectations. You know, normally the repairs we are doing, I might classify as urgent, but not emergency. And so just realizing like how important it was to tarp people's roofs, it was a little bit different. And so I think that we've got a better understanding now of what needs to happen. But I will say, you know, we were fortunate, again, that we had a pretty major funder provide some flexibility to us. And without that flexibility, we would not have had the emergency funds available. And so I think that's still a big gap to make sure that there's funding available to do the repair work and that needs to be done.
So some of the flexibility in your response to these storms came from a funder. Were there any other sources that contributed to the effort?
Yes. Homes Incorporated, which is a nonprofit, does the same thing we do in Whitesburg in Letcher County. They're actually the ones that had the idea to try to create an emergency response and reached out to the funder and said, would you do this? Provided some flexibility. And so Seth Long it was his idea, and it was great. And I think they ended up doing somewhere between 10 and 15 and just Letcher County. It was wonderful to get that kind of flexibility and have some resources to provide the needed repairs.
And it's always nice to hear counties in Eastern Kentucky working together in their communities.
Yeah, there's a great network through Federation of Appalachian Housing of probably 10 or 12 housing agencies in Eastern Kentucky that really do cooperate and share scarce resources and knowledge. And it's a great network, and it's great to be part of it.
Scott McReynolds, Executive Director of the Housing Development Alliance. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Robert Brubaker has mentored thousands of undergraduate and graduate students for close to 37 years, serving as a chair in the psychology department for 17 of those years at Eastern Kentucky University. In preparing for this interview, I talked with one of Dr. Brubaker's colleagues and was told that anyone I talk with will tell me that he is a true visionary leader and an advocate for students, staff, and faculty. And now he's preparing to retire. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Brubaker.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What sorts of changes have you seen over time in the ways that students are being trained to become clinicians? And I'm sure that that is influenced by the changing times.
Absolutely. The whole mental health field has really evolved over the past several decades, and there's much more emphasis on accountability and providing evidence-based interventions. Being able to demonstrate that what we're doing with a client has some value added and that it's actually helping based on empirical evidence. So one thing that's changed is the nature of the training we provide students, the kinds of interventions we train them to perform. Another challenge really too has been to train students to work with the broader clientele that we now attract. You know, we've gone from a fairly narrow client population where we really weren't treating people with more severe mental illnesses. We weren't doing all the things that, you know, we need to be doing now with clients who are suicidal, danger to themselves or others. So we've had to provide training for students in a much broader array of interventions. And also technology is changing, and that's really impacting how mental health services are delivered. So especially, you know, in the current environment, the pandemic and the social distancing requirements and kind of staying at home, we really emphasize training students in telehealth, delivering services via the telehealth platforms. And that fits very nicely with the general mission of our doctoral program, which is to serve underserved clients, including clients in rural communities where mental health services aren't always as accessible, or specialized populations, for example, children, adults with autism. So telehealth is really, and kind of embracing that technology and really teaching our students how to use it effectively has been a significant change in focus.
I would say that the pandemic has really brought telehealth to the forefront, hasn't it? Because of the ability to interact in a way that doesn't expose people?
It sure has, yeah. And you know, I think in the medical field, telehealth has probably moved a little more quickly than it has in behavioral health. But you're right, the pandemic has really forced the issue. You know, we realized early on that if we wanted to continue providing services to our clients when all of this hit, that we're going to have to move to this alternative means of service delivery.
These are difficult times, to put it mildly, for everybody. I'd say everybody in their own way is experiencing some sort of psychological challenge right now. And I know you interact with students a lot. And I wonder what you can tell us about how those interactions have gone among students who are trying to deal with all the ramifications of this pandemic.
Well, this has impacted our students significantly. You know, Eastern has a pretty diverse student population. So, you know, we range from your sort of traditional 18 to 22-year-old right out of high school, full-time college student to non-traditional students, students who are single parents, students who are working to support their families, working to pay for their education. And all of the changes caused by the pandemic have hit them really hard. So, you know, our students are now, in addition to worrying about, you know, getting their classwork done and meeting all their normal responsibilities, some of them are out of work, some of them have no place to live, some of them are home with kids all day. Even the more traditional age college students are not here on campus with the library and the dorms and the support services that might normally be in place. They're back home where they have other people, you know, living with them and distracting them and may not have internet access. So I think it's caused a lot of additional stress on our students. And, you know, of course, the past couple of months, I'm only interacting with students via email. but I've certainly seen evidence in those email exchanges of students really struggling to cope with the additional demands, worrying about their classes, not doing as well in classes as they could be, concerned about the effect it's going to have on their GPA, their graduation. Not only am I seeing that, I know our faculty are seeing it as well. Plus, they're all having to adjust to online classes. You know, we have a significant number of students in our online program, and they're kind of used to the rhythm of online classes and the technology. Well, our on-campus students are not nearly as familiar with that format for teaching, that platform, and have also had to adapt to some of those new demands.
So I've been checking up on you a little bit, Bob, and I'm told by folks in your office that you have very broad tastes in music, a little bit of classical, some jazz, R&B, bluegrass, some rock. You never know what's going to be on when you walk into the office.
Every now and then, I would get the urge to hear something, and it could range from Broadway show tunes to this country western duo or bluegrass or who knows what, classical music. And I would find that music on YouTube and crank up the volume, and the whole office would kind of rock out for 10 or 15 minutes. always at high volume.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So how did this interest in the arts, both visual and music, how did that expand into art therapy as a concentration that's now being offered to psychology majors at EKU?
Well, you know, I became aware of art therapy a long time ago. I was trained as a clinical child psychologist, so did a lot of work with kids with behavior disorders. And even before I really knew what formal art therapy was, I often incorporated art activities into work with kids. You know, you can't, it's really not appropriate or helpful to sit and talk, try and have talking therapy with 4, 5, 6-year-old, 7-year-old kids. So I often incorporated drawing and coloring and painting into my work with kids. As I became interested in the many ways that psychology and art kind of interact, I kind of began to focus on art therapy again as a formal discipline. And art therapy has really evolved over the last decade or so. For a long time, there wasn't a lot of empirical support for art therapy interventions. I think a number of people didn't really take it seriously in the mental health field. But more recently, the empirical evidence has started to accumulate, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that it's effective and works really well with certain populations. So when I was teaching the psychology of art class in Paris, that was a natural thing to incorporate into that curriculum. Students were interested in it. We had the great fortune of living in Paris in a neighborhood across the street from where we lived with the students during the program. It was one of the oldest psychiatric hospitals in Europe. So there were, and it was a center for training and research in art therapy. So I was able to take the students over to meet with the staff at that hospital every year and talk with the art therapist, talk with the director. They also have one of the largest collections of art produced by patients in Europe, ranging back to 1800s. So that's kind of how the art therapy interest evolved in that context. And then we also, of course, have incorporated it into the doctoral program. As I was saying, the art therapy profession discipline has gained some momentum here lately with the evidence that it really works. And the chair of the art department and I were talking one day and noticed that we were getting more and more inquiries from students, undergraduate students, who were interested in being art therapists and were interested in the training that might be required. So she and I collaborated to create this art therapy, sort of pre-art therapy concentration as part of our undergraduate psychology bachelor's degree program. So in order to complete that concentration, students take about 18 hours of psychology classes that are required to get into master's programs in art therapy. And they complete a studio art minor, which is also a requirement for getting into master's programs in art therapy. So it's a very nice collaborative effort between art and design and psychology, and serving the needs of an increasing number of students who are interested in that profession.
Well, going back to your connections with France, I'm told that you will answer to either Bob or Pierre and that you've established this tradition of assigning a French name to all psychology department student office workers, administrative assistants. How does that affect things around the office?
Well, I think it's just fine. What happened was I began studying French years ago when I started going to teach in Paris. We were having our usual experience with everybody talking at once and nobody listening to me and kind of, you know, how faculty meetings can go. So in the midst of one of those meetings where everybody was talking, I made a motion to adopt French as the second official language of the psychology department. I was the only one who voted, and I voted yes. And from that point on, we conducted much of our business in French. And I began assigning French names to our student workers, a few colleagues. There are some people in other departments, other offices on campus that now have French names. And I suspect it probably annoyed some of my colleagues on the faculty, but I think the rest of us in the office kind of enjoyed it. We would practice little conversations between student workers and I. I thought it was quite cosmopolitan and international.
Well, I have many more questions for you, but the time is ticking away, and I do want to get to this one before we close. And just ask you if you could think about it, some of your favorite, your funniest memories from your time at EKU.
I'm not sure about funniest memories. I can remember one time, this is a long time ago, most of the faculty in our department serve as advisors. And one week during advising season, one of my colleagues was going to be out of the office, and I agreed to take on his advisees while he was gone. And he put a sign on his door, you know, if you need advising, go to Dr. Brubaker's office. I put a sign on my office saying, if you need advising, go to Dr. Borden's office. Dr. Borden put a sign on her office, if you need advising, go to Dr. So-and-so's office. And we had students kind of circling the building.
That's kind of messing with folks' minds, I'd say, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, we're psychologists, so that's kind of... kind of what we're known for.
Well, Dr. Robert Brubaker getting ready to retire after 17 years as chair of the Department of Psychology here at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.